John Ford's 1956 Western The Searchers routinely makes critics' lists of the greatest films ever made. It stars John Wayne, Vera Miles, Jeffrey Hunter, a teenage Natalie Wood, and several character actors like Ward Bond, who are familiar to anyone who's seen a lot of Westerns. I suspect most of the film's admirers are unaware that it was based on actual events, the abduction of 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker in 1836. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Frankel tells the stories of the film's making and the remarkable history behind it in his new book called The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Glenn Frankel to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Nice to be here, Leonard.
You begin your book with the history that underpins the movie, the story of Cynthia Ann Parker and her family. Can you tell us about them and especially about Cynthia Ann?
Well, the Parker family is sort of a typical American pioneer family. They start out from Virginia and Maryland and sort of work their way west after the Revolutionary War, kicking down the gates of, you know, Western, you know, to first into Tennessee and then Illinois and then to Texas. And about 40 of them settle and build a fortified farming settlement in central Texas, right at the edge of Indian territory. The land is good, there's water, there's all this, but eventually, inevitably, Comanche and Kiowas come down, and in May 1836, there's a raid on the settlement. 5 men are killed. 5 young people are abducted, including 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker. And she's hauled off to Comanche territory. She's adopted by a Comanche family. She spends 24 years as a Comanche. She becomes a wife and a mother and spends 24 years in captivity.
Then who found her and how?
Well, 24 years later, there's another raid, only this time it's U.S. Cavalry and Texas Rangers. And they kill people around her, and they haul her off and her little baby daughter named Prairie Flower, and they take her back to white civilization, and they restore her to her family, to the Parker family. Of course, the only problem is after 24 years, she's a Comanche, and she doesn't want to be back with the Texas family, and she misses her 2 Comanche sons and her husband, and she has a miserable time. She's sort of a mini celebrity, you know. They show her around. They take her even to the state legislature, but she never gets comfortable. She's an embarrassment to them.
Well, they saw her as spoiled, I imagine. She'd gone native.
She had, you know, they were kind to her. They were not shunning her. They just didn't know what to do. They didn't have psychology or sociology. They didn't understand why she wasn't, you know, grateful to be back in Christendom and, you know, to be back in redemption. And so gradually they send her off to a family sawmill in East Texas, and we don't hear any more from this celebrity. When she dies, there's no obituary. There's still a lot of debate over when she died.
But her son achieves a certain amount of fame. We'll get to that a little later. 120 years after her abduction, John Ford's The Searchers comes out. And it's interesting, it's not set in 1836. It's set in after the Civil War. And John Wayne is wearing gray, which would suggest that he had been a Confederate soldier.
Well, Alan LeMay, a screenwriter and Western novelist, took this story, did some research, schmushed together a number of captivity narratives, with Cynthia Ann's being the main one, and produces this wonderful novel in 1954. And yes, then John Ford, the great director of Westerns, comes along. He recruits John Wayne, his favorite actor. They go to Monument Valley, and they make this incredible film. And by moving it forward, LeMay accomplished a few things. It's at the time when Comanche power is finally being crushed after a 40-year war, the longest war on American soil between Comanches and Texans. It also allows him to create a more complex character, because it is an ex-Confederate soldier. There was an uncle who searched for Cynthia Ann unsuccessfully for 8 years, but that's way back in the 1840s. This time it's a Confederate veteran. It's a different world, and it allows LeMay to do some things, and then Ford, of course, comes along.
It also allows them to inject the whole concept of race into it.
Exactly, exactly. And race is so essential in the novel and then especially in the film. The film has a number of, if you will, modern themes that we can appreciate today, especially about race, the attitudes towards Native Americans, the fact that one of the 2 searchers, a fictional character, has some Native American blood. So you've got that going on. But at the same time, all of the psychosexual parts of this that exist existed in the original stories and that were fears that the pioneers had. But John Ford raises those right to the surface of
the
movie.
Do you think Ford was aware of the original story?
Oh, yes. Ford read a lot of American history, and I know he knew about Cynthia Ann and her surviving Comanche son. He even commissioned a screenplay at one point about the son, so he was well aware of the original tale.
Well, he was probably more sympathetic to the history of Native Americans than other directors of Westerns, but less so in this movie.
Well, he was aware, and he had a very paternalistic attitude about the Navajo in Monument Valley.
Well, but also Cheyenne Autumn.
Well, that comes later. You see, that's at the end for Ford. Throughout the years, Ford uses Native Americans as extras and cast members, and he treats them in this kind of paternalistic manner. But he's a man of his time. He, as he himself says, I killed more Indians than anybody else. Yes, he treated them as, you know, he treated them with respect on the set, but in the films, it's wildly different. It depends on who's writing the scripts. It depends on the nature of the story. It's only as time goes on. And again, with Cheyenne Autumn, of course, that's a much different story. But Searchers, in Searchers, the Comanches are rapists. They're pillagers. You think of them as the evil other at the beginning. As the movie goes on, some of that is mitigated because after you've seen a raid on the family, you see another the results of a raid on a Comanche village, and there are men and women, bodies scattered around. But that's not to say that it's very sympathetic.
Well, on the other hand, the John Wayne character makes us a little more sympathetic toward the Indians. This is probably the first really negative role that he had, or at least mixed role that he had. It allowed him to show off his acting chops in a way he hadn't in the past.
Well, that's right. I mean, Ford and Wayne made something like a dozen movies before Searchers.
Well, Ford made him famous with the Stagecoach.
With Stagecoach, which is a wonderful film. And, you know, before the Wayne that we know as the lumbering kind of, you know, toupee-wearing figure of the late 60s, you know, the Vietnam War guy, he was an actor. And the earlier John Wayne is a fascinating actor. He's very charismatic in The Searchers. We want him to succeed, and yet as the film goes on, it's clear that his motivation is very complex. He's not going out to rescue this little girl, but because over the course of the 7 years or so, she's become a Comanche woman, and she's had sex with Indians, he resolves to go kill her. It's an honor killing. But he's not comfortable with this because he's John Wayne, because he's this character. So all through the film, he's wrestling with this incredible burden of feeling that he needs to seek vengeance, but at the same time, you know, feeling very poorly about it. And that's the beauty of the portrait, because it's doing both at the same time.
Now, critics all praise this film because it's really one of the great American films, and movie fans love it. But it is really not all that well known these days. Is it because Westerns have kind of waned in popularity?
I think that's a large part of it. Also, John Ford didn't do himself any favors in the sense he always said, well, I'm just a workman. You know, don't tell me about meanings here. I don't want to talk about any of that. He always sort of poo-pooed it. He won 4 Academy Awards for Best Director, more than any other director. But at the same time, I don't think people, younger people, certainly don't know much about John Ford today.
Well, Westerns served the same kind of purpose that science fiction has later. They often were metaphors for what's going on in the real world. How would that apply to The Searchers?
Well, The Searchers is part of, you can interpret it as one of those, you know, Cold War films where the Indians play the part of the Reds, of the invaders, and, you know, and the settlers stand in for us in our modern community. You're right. We look at Westerns, first of all, because they're good stories, you know, getting the bad guys. But we also look at them because they tell us a story about the country, about how we were founded. They hearken back to a simpler time when, you know, there was good and bad and we were the good guys. So that, you know, that was very satisfying too in the years of Cold War anxiety.
He also is playing in the whole idea of the mythic past because he sets it in Monument Valley, one of the most gorgeous places in the country. You can't help but be just awed. I've been to Monument Valley,
yeah.
And I can't see it without thinking, gee, I know this place because I've seen all those John Ford movies.
Well, exactly. I had the same feeling when I went there 5 years ago. You know, when you grow up in like Rochester, New York, where I did, or in New York City, you think of Texas like Monument Valley, the stark.
And
know,
it isn't in Texas.
No, it's not in Texas.
It's in the Four
Arizona,
Corners.
Exactly, Arizona and Utah. And there's very little in Texas that looks anything like this. But in our minds, Ford's telling a fable. He begins with this little scene that says, Texas, 1868. And then you open the door and it's Monument Valley. What he's saying is this is a fable. This is a story about a myth. So take it for that.
And there's a lot of door opening in this movie. That's almost like a visual theme.
Very much so. I counted, I think, 9 different moments, starting when you're inside a dark place and you're looking out. Caves and doors opening at the beginning and closing at the end. And this was one of the things, you know, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, all of whom saw this movie when they were growing up and loved it. And they constantly quoted in their own films. And the door opening and closing is probably the most quoted thing of all.
So it had a real impact on directors who followed.
Very much so. You know, when the film came out, it got pretty good reviews. It did some good box office, no Academy Awards, and it kind of vanished. But then in the 60s and 70s, as John Ford and Howard Hawks and these Hollywood directors begin to be re-examined, and as you have these
Because
young
of the
guys,
French, largely.
Because of the French, largely. But then you have these young guys coming along who become great filmmakers early on, and they're constantly quoting this movie. And so it begins to reassert itself.
But when you look at some old films, classics, you do see creaky spots. Are there any creaky spots in this film?
I think the thing that puts off people these days is the sort of cornball humor that Ford injected here and there, partly because he was an Irishman and he loved that stuff, and partly because the original story is so grim and relentless with the murders and rapes. You don't see them in the film, but you know about them, and the traumatic impact of these events on the survivors. So Ford felt that, you know, like Shakespeare, he needed to have some buffoons, he needed to have some cornball things, and some people love that stuff. I happen to, but a lot of folks don't.
Where was he in his career at this point? Because he made something like 200 movies, didn't he?
He did, and he started in the silent era. His first film was a Western in 1917, so he spans all these generations. By 1955, when they shoot The Searchers, he's in his early 60s, but he's a lifelong alcoholic. He's had his gallbladder removed. He's only got one good eye. He's both mature and kind of down, and his friends find him this novel as a way to sort of reassert himself because Westerns were his great thing. But this movie is the movie of an older man. It's more complex. He gives us the great John Wayne character in all his charismatic glory, the Indian fighter, the man on horseback. But at the same time, he's undermining that myth constantly because the man on horseback turns out to be something of a psychopath.
I was going to ask if he saw something of himself in that character, Ethan Edwards.
Oh, I think he very much did. I think he, Wayne's character in many ways often embodied some of Ford's own demons. Ford, being an alcoholic, he had a very tough relationship with family and friends. He could be very abusive, physically abusive, even to the people he loved or who loved him. And the Wayne character is very much an isolated man. Yes, he helps rescue the damsel, but he himself doesn't get to participate in the civilization he's helped create.
My guest is Glenn Frankel, whose book, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend, is published by Bloomsbury. You're a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. How did you wind up choosing this as a topic?
Well, I'd been overseas. I was a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post for many years. And when I came back and I ended up teaching at Stanford University for a while, I started looking for an American book. I mean, again, as a foreign correspondent, you want to write about the place you're in. And I'd always loved The Searchers, just like the great directors. I'd loved it as a kid, and I always thought I'd come back to it. So what could be more American than John Ford or than, you know, pursuing this thing? What I didn't know, I thought I was just doing a making of the movie kind of book, but then I discovered this original story, and suddenly the thing opened up, and I found myself in a 5-year search of my own.
And this really is, as you said earlier, to some degree about politics, because the Cold War is reflected in it. Now, John Wayne was famously conservative. What about Ford?
Ford starts out as a sort of liberal Republican from Maine. He makes The Grapes of Wrath in the late 30s, which is probably the most left-wing, socialist-oriented Hollywood film ever made. So he comes out, he's a social liberal. As time goes on, I think he becomes more conservative after he's very pro-military. He serves in the war, of course. But he never was as right-wing as Wayne. He even defended people who were being pushed onto the blacklist at times. but he becomes a pro-Vietnam. You know, he's kind of one of those Democrat, you know, liberals who turn very hawkish as time goes on. He didn't share Wayne's very simplistic views.
You mentioned that he could be abusive. You describe him urinating on a crew member's bed. Why would he do something like that? And why would people put up with that?
It's interesting. They all were abused by him. At the same time, he created this sort of John Ford stock company of supporting actors, wranglers, stuntmen, cameramen, these folks, and they worked with him again and again. He chose good people and he kept them. It was a bit out of loyalty, but it also was the sense that when they were working with John Ford, they knew they were working on something special, something enduring. I think it's largely the same reason that John Wayne stayed with him.
Now, there were many cases of Indians abducting pioneers or farmers and ranchers before, even during colonial days, as far back as the 1600s. Did the case of Cynthia Ann Parker stand out for some reason?
Well, you're right. I mean, the captivity narrative became really our first literary genre in America. And the stories from New England are the first big wave of these. And then, though, with the settlement of Texas, you get another sort of edition of this in the Plains Indian Wars. And there are many, many captivity going on there, in part because Comanches were kidnapping a lot of people to service their horse-driven economy. And so there's a new wave, and the Texans have a way of approaching it. And the war between the Texans and Comanches, the abductions become, you know, ground zero for the anger and the hatred.
Do you think that one of the reasons we remember this story is because of her son, Quanah Parker?
Well, yes, that's the one character we haven't spoken about.
Cynthia, now, how did he wind up with her name? He's a Comanche.
Well, after she's captured, he continues to be with the Comanches and to be a warrior and a chief. And then after the Comanche power is crushed in the 1870s and he goes into, you know, the Indian Agency, Quanah manages to learn how to navigate, to turn from that career of warrior to a career as a sort of conciliator, middleman, businessman, politician. And he often cites her story, the fact that she was white, as the reason that he preached conciliation between the two races. So he becomes this fascinating figure. Teddy Roosevelt dines at his house in Cache, Oklahoma. He meets many people. And without him, I don't think the Comanches would have survived. They were down to less than 3,000 people at the time of the surrender. In many ways, it was more dangerous for them to be the wards of the American government, which was trying to crush their culture, than it had been when they were at war with the American government. And without Quanah, I don't think they would have made it. So he's a fascinating and heroic figure.
And he had a large family. The white family, the Parker family, was also large. So there must be a lot of descendants around today. Were you able to talk to any of them?
Indeed. I mean, one of the fascinating things for me was to find there was a contemporary moment in this book as well, because you have the Comanche side of the family through Quanah, hundreds and hundreds of relatives and people. And then you have the Texan sides through the Parker family. And the two sides hold annual family reunions, one in Oklahoma, one in Texas, and they send emissaries to each other's reunion and they trade a silver bowl. They're very proud of their heritage. And they, too, my book is partly about storytellers and about the way that each generation retells the story. And these families are still retelling it.
I still wonder whether it wouldn't have been a good idea to have set the film in 1836 when she was abducted. Texas was then still part of Mexico, and the United States under President Andrew Jackson was forcing over 100,000 Indians out of the southeastern part of the United States, leading to what became known as the Trail of Tears. There are all sorts of other subtexts at that time.
These are rich subjects, and every storyteller has to choose the story that fits his or her needs. For Ford and for Alan LeMay, the novelist, they were looking at the impact of the violence on the settler families, what had happened to them, how they coped with it. And for there were many, many more abductions over time, and therefore that's the time they chose.
And you quote John Wayne as saying, "I don't feel we did wrong in taking this great country away from them. There were great numbers of people who needed new land, and the Indians were selfishly trying to keep it for themselves."
There you go. There's the imperial justification for you.
Was he aware of the Trail of Tears, you think?
I'm not sure about Wayne. I know that Ford was well aware of all these things, was a great reader and scholar of American history. But John Wayne read books, too, but I don't know what he knew about this.
Now, there is another interesting bit of trivia connected to this film. Marion C. Cooper, who is the man who gave us King Kong, produced The Searchers, and his wife is one of the actors in it?
Dorothy Jordan plays Martha in the beginning of the movie.
The first woman we see.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, Cooper was Ford's business partner. He helped find the novel. He helped rescue Ford. Ford always needed rescuing. And lucky for him, he had loyal friends like Marion C. Cooper who came through for him.
He needed rescuing because people considered him difficult to work for?
He was difficult to work with. He was physically a mess. He was a lifelong alcoholic. It was painful for him. He tried to create a world where he had control. That's really why he loved going to Monument Valley. It was 600 miles, you know, from the nearest train track, and he could do his work there away from the studio guys. Ford needed control over his environment, and he relied on people like Marion Cooper and John Wayne, for that matter, to give it to him.
Now, it's considered one of the great films of all time. And yet you say that it got mixed reviews, a mixed response at the time. Why do you think that was? Why didn't people see this film, which is so beautifully made, so gorgeous to look at, so fabulously acted, and so dramatic, as something that is quite wonderful?
There were many, many Westerns. It was still not considered an artistic genre. Ford's four Academy Awards, not one of them comes from a Western that he made. It comes from other things. And so I think, and John Wayne was considered a pretty good cowboy actor, and that was that. And so they missed the meanings. They missed those layers of meaning because the sensibility was so different in 1956.
Glenn Frankel worked for 27 years for the Washington Post as a reporter, a foreign correspondent, and editor of the Washington Post magazine. When he was Jerusalem bureau chief, he won the 1989 Pulitzer Prize for, quote, sensitive and balanced reporting from Israel and the Middle East. I guess we can't say there is balanced and sensible reporting on what happened in the Indian Wars in The Searchers, but there sure is great art here. And does great art, do you think, sometimes trump reality and a true depiction of history?
I think great art and myth, American myth, always trump history, always use
history. Well, John
history.
Ford talked about that in the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, didn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. The famous line about, you know, when the legend contradicts the reality, print the legend.
So that's
what
he's
doing.
Ford
gives us both. He gives us both. And that's the great, that's the artistry, I think, of The Searchers.
Meanwhile, I guess a few people remember the original story, and you have revived that for us. I wonder what actually did happen at the end of her life.
Well, she died in obscurity. She clearly was very lonely and unhappy. But she was the ultimate victim of these wars.
Although she may have been proud of what her son was doing. Glenn Frankel, The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thanks for having me.